Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the official Tennis.com podcast, featuring professional coach and community leader, Kamau Murray.
Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I'm your host, Kamau Murray, and we are here with one of the most revered and legendary coaches in all of college tennis. 29 years at the University of Georgia. Most recently, as a first or second freshman to ever win the NCAAs as a freshman, Ethan Quinn. We're here with Manny Diaz. Manny, thanks for coming on the show.
Great to be with you, Kamau.
So when you hear 29 years, I mean, I did like 6 years with the player, and I can only imagine 29 years on a tennis court. It has to be more interesting because the players keep shuffling in, so you keep it fresh. Yeah. For 6 years, the one player was a lot. So how does it feel to be in one place for 29 years, and what is next?
Well, you know, the good thing about my position, because I don't want to call it a job, right? You and I know it takes more than that type of mentality. It's a way of life, right? And it's a mission. It's something we really enjoy, you know, coming in every day to kind of just help get people better, right? But with us, it's even if it's year to year, when you change or you graduate one or two players, and this last year we graduated five. We had five fifth-year seniors, graduate seniors, that decided to come back. They got that extra year, you know, year from COVID, and you know, so we were together, four of them, for 5 years, and that was a long time. But to be honest with you, you know, if you recruit the right kids and you have the right kids, you know, it's a joy, right? It's a lot of fun seeing them progress, seeing them at times, you know, their goals change a little bit. Some of them, you know, want to continue to be on that path to becoming pros, and some decide, you know, that they're good with being a great college player, but they have other ambitions, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, getting back to you know, how you stay fresh, you say 29 years, that's 29 years as a head coach. I've been there for 41 years because I did six with Coach McGill as his associate head coach. So 41 years, when I kind of remind myself of that, it's pretty mind-blowing.
Oh, man. And then you play things. And then you play.
Yeah, then before that's right. So it's over 50 years in and around Athens, Georgia, and you know, it's scary how quickly it has all moved. You know, it's all gone.
Now, you just said you had five seniors graduate, right? And when I think of UGA, hey, that's a scary thought, because when you have a powerhouse like that, that year after year is top 10 in the country, competing for a national championship, and you lose five. Right.
Yeah.
Then you got to go, where do I go and find five more ballers? Right. Do I go to Junior French and look for those who make it to the round of 16, make it to the round of 32, maybe not physically quite ready to go pro? Maybe they come spend a year. Do I go to Junior Wimby and see what happens? How do you replace five guys at that level when you're competing with other schools like UCLA, TCU, Texas?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it starts way before, you know, the year prior, you know, so, you know, you obviously start recruiting these kids at the beginning, you know, when they're going into their junior year. Hopefully you've watched them play. They've seen you there, you know, with some interest. You can't communicate with them now until they're past that sophomore year. So that makes it a little bit tougher. It's a little bit more challenging. But, you know, you track these kids from the first year of 16 and second year 16 and then onward. And, you know, we knew we had some huge shoes to fill. But, we got on board pretty good. And, you know, we have the number one recruiting class in the country. We've got Alex Mickelson, who's already 265 or 260. Ignacio Buse from Peru, who was up to number 9 ITF junior in the world. And then we have three, believe it or not, this is exciting for me. We have three kids whose dad or mom played tennis at Georgia. So now I'm coaching my former players. Well, my former players' kids. I'm going like, whoa. So we have Bobby Marinchik's son. He was an All-America at Georgia, got to the finals of the NCAA doubles with Wade McGuire in 92-93. And his son, Parker Marinchik, Eddie Jakes' son, Parker Jakes, and Davis Taylor, Mariana Land, who played for our women's program when they won a national championship. Her son, Davis Taylor, is coming to join us as well. So we've got five kids, and we added recently another player through the portal from USC. Ryan Colby is going to be joining us as well. And hey, we're always looking. We're always looking, and it takes a while to establish relationships and get to the point where you're able to attract the top kids to replace some big shoes, to really fill some big shoes.
Well, you mentioned like first year 16, second year 16. You were at my facility, you know, for the indoors. And so you see,
gorgeous.
We could host two college matches at one time. It's the most beautiful thing to watch when you see two top 16 teams in the country competing against each other. And you see the momentum shift from court to court. But we also have a lot of opportunity to see junior tournaments here because we host a lot of junior events here. And with UTR, I see a lot of 12, 13, 14-year-olds so worried about their UTR, not necessarily worried, ducking matches. Like if they're losing the main draw, they want to duck a back draw match or just pulling out. And so it's really interesting to hear you say, we started watching first year. I mean, unless the kid's a stud at 13 or 14, right? You're like tracking them. With first year 16s where you really start to get serious about a player, what would be your advice to the players that are overly managing their UTR now, perhaps not developing toughness, not showing up to win? Because let me tell you, your number 5 guy tomorrow may be playing somebody with a UTR lower than him. He can't duck that match. You expect him to show up and win, right? So what can you give the parents on managing that?
I honestly think they need to realize that coaches, you know, that's what they're looking for. They're looking, you know, how these kids, number one, handle adversity on the court, how they're handling the fact that their opponent may have given them a bad call, the umpire, missed a call, how they're handling tough, difficult situations, how they handle when they lose in the main draw. Do they walk away? Do they kind of just fake an injury? You know, people need to hear that coaches do notice that. And that's something that tells us a significant amount. We take that very seriously. You know, we see, the bottom of the lineup as every bit as important. You need somebody to be manning the number one and two positions, but really where championships are won is at the bottom, right? I think they have to realize that the top college coaches, or probably all college coaches, are looking for kids that are tenacious, that have grit, that have tenacity, that have the fight, that can handle adversity. So for me, character is at the very top. You know, my mentor, Coach Dan McGill, used to say, well, there's talent a dime a dozen. You know, there's talented people everywhere. The most talented people are not necessarily always the ones that rise to the top. It's the kid with passion. It's the kid with, you know, a fight, with pride, with toughness. Because as you know well, a tennis match is not always on the ascendancy or always on the descendancy. There's momentum flows and you got to grab on and hold on, but then you got to minimize when things are going against you. So it's a sport where there's a lot of ebbs and flows, and how you manage and how you handle those is of utmost importance. So that's one thing I look for when I'm out there watching. And I think that's something that kids need to know is important to most coaches.
Now, you mentioned that championship's the one at the bottom, right? And right now, I can only imagine being a college coach with a kid that was probably top 75 in the world, ITF, that you're going to come, and maybe it's because of size or just age, you're going to come and ask him to play number five, right?
Mm-hmm.
With now the portal. Because now the kids have an opportunity to say, hey, I'm top dog from Colombia or Peru or France, and now I got to come in and play, you know, four, five, or six. I may opt to go to the portal where I can play number one, right? How do you manage that now? Recruiting all the top guys, getting to be in the team, and understand that that five and six position is like, that wins the title for us.
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple of aspects there. I think that number one is, you know, the kids that come to Georgia wind up loving Georgia, right? Wind up loving the people that we have in the locker room. So the culture has a lot to do with whether you retain players or you don't. So I think just establishing, just looking for, if you're a young prospect coming up, a 16, 17 year old, you know, looking for a place where you're going to love being around this group of people. You love the culture of the program. I think that's imperative for kids to find out. What I tell people is, you know, if you're playing number five your freshman year and you come in and you're 15-1, you're going to have opportunities to move up, at least in our program. So if you handle a position with great success, you're going to continue to move up, because I'm only looking to improve our chances. And if you're developing, I think that is the biggest question is, are kids feeling like they're developing? Are they really just fulfilling their own promise? And I think that if we keep harping on this every day at practice, just about, are you making the guy across the net from you better today? Are you just improving that 1% on a given day? And I think that if we commit to pushing each other, I think everybody's level is going to rise, and I think you're going to fulfill your potential, and you're going to feel like you're improving. And that's what it's all about. I mean, we've seen number two players and number three players in the lineup win an NCAA championship. So it doesn't preclude you. I think that, I think in college, kids also get the opportunity to learn that, hey, the world doesn't revolve around you all the time. You need to work in a team setting. And again, like I said before, you need to make the guy across the net better that day, whether you're having a good day and he's not. It's your responsibility to lift him up. And it's your responsibility to call him out when his behavior is not appropriate, right? I'm also there to do that. But it's only when you see that inertia take place, that momentum where guys are holding each other accountable, that's when we can fulfill our promise as a team.
So the most famous Georgia Bulldog is John Isner. And John always, he kills me. Sometimes we'll be on tour, we're sitting there eating lunch, and like, yeah, I couldn't play basketball at Georgia. I was like, bro, let me tell you, no tennis player is playing tennis if they could have played basketball at Georgia, right? You could not play basketball just because you're 6'10". You could only play tennis at that level of school. Tell us about John on campus.
Well, John was so goofy and lovable, really. He showed up on campus 6'9" and a half or so. He always says he's 6'9", 6'9" and a half. He's like 6'11".
Right.
But anyway, he was fun. He was, he's always laughing. He's got a great sense of humor, self-deprecating in many ways. He doesn't take himself too seriously. And I think, that was one of the most impressive things about him. He never, while he was one of the most competitive guys I've ever been around, he also was a fabulous teammate. And he was easy to get along with. I used to have to change drills every 5 to 10 minutes because he couldn't do a drill more than 10 minutes without getting bored.
Yeah.
He was a little hyper. He was a little, all over the place, but he just loved the game, and he was a great competitor. So you know, he was obviously a great addition to our team, and he always gives credit to his college years at Georgia with, you know, with establishing a great foundation for him. But, you know, he just grew into his body. He gained 45 pounds of muscle. His freshman year, he actually didn't even finish his freshman year postseason play. By the time we got done with our regular season, his back was so tight. He had to actually sit out some of the matches towards the end of the season, went home, didn't do much that first. He didn't play much that first summer, but he came back and dedicated himself to becoming a little bit more flexible. He couldn't even touch his toes. So he went really, he went from being the most inflexible player we had. He had zero flexibility to being our most flexible player by the time he got done at Georgia. And he has dedicated himself to taking care of his body like nobody's business. He's just really conscientious about it. And that's why his career has been so lengthy out there.
Oh, man, super steady. Now, when you recruit him, because we see on tour now, it's like, you know, we evaluate pro talent based on, you know, everyone has a big serve. Everyone got a big forehand. Yeah. Now we start to say, can a guy move, right? We see Alcaraz, Djokovic, right. All the greats kind of move. John is not one that you look at and say, okay, this guy can move. So when you were recruiting him, were you thinking, I'll just play him at one, he'll serve his way to six all, and we'll go 50-50 in the tiebreakers, and he'll like win half of them at number one four? Because honestly, in college tennis, right, sometimes we can hide our number three player.
Right.
If they're the biggest server at number one and not necessarily depend on them to win. When you were recruiting John, what was your thought process?
I thought he'd be pretty good. And to be honest, his freshman year, he played mostly at number three. You know, he just did a great job for us. But we had some more experienced players. I also didn't want to – he could have probably played two, and he played some at two or one. And he did get some opportunities. I wanted to make sure that he came along and he was able to, you know, like, for example, when he showed up on our campus, you know, I said, dude, with that serve and your not lack of mobility for a better way, you know, like you're not Michael Chang out there, you know, like you need to serve in volley. So I said, if you want to be a complete player, I mean, and you want to play up to your potential, I think you need to start, you know, serving and volleying a lot. And he did it. That doesn't mean like I know that's not his style, but he's able to do it. And that was something that from the get-go just struck me how coachable he was. If you asked him to do something for a particular purpose and you could sell that to him, he could actually compute it. And his ego didn't get in the way. In other words, winning a practice set wasn't as important as the bigger goal of, you know, becoming a better player. This is what you need to go to the next level or to take the next step. And he was so willing to do it, and he didn't put his ego on the line. And that was one of the special things about John, whether he won a match or lost a match. I mean, like, he hated to lose. Don't get me wrong. He hated to lose, but he never took that personally. He never really saw, well, I'm lesser of a person or of a competitor because I lost a match. Today, maybe I got outplayed. He always kept things in perspective and, you know, a special kid.
Mm. So I'll go back, right? So we're talking about pros. Prior to going into college tennis, you coached the Jensen brothers, right?
No, Murphy Jensen came. Murphy came to Jensen, transferred from USC to Georgia for his last 2 years of college. And Murphy and Al Parker played doubles together. They did very well. And then after college, Murphy went and joined his brother who had graduated from USC a few years earlier and won the French Open. Yeah.
Now, how was Murphy? Murphy, to me, and his son Billy, right? Murphy is one of the greatest guys, and I always what really stands out to me is when you hear like Luke talk about the French Open final championship that almost didn't happen, right? Because he was so nervous and he couldn't get out of bed, wasn't feeling right. Tell me about Murphy. I mean, just those two guys have like are like a staple in tennis because of their personality. So I can only imagine in a team setting.
Yeah, no, Murphy was a hoot. You know, I've never seen anybody, you know, that never had a bad day. I mean, like, he came to practice. He was always joking. He was always loud. He was always slapping hands. And he was great to have. He was great to have. I think he's just one of the outstanding personalities in tennis. And it's been great to see him having tremendous success.
So I got a hard question for you. So, I you know, Tommy Paul always talks about how he wanted to go to North Carolina but didn't get offered a full scholarship, right?
Yeah.
So that was a miss. So what kid did you miss, right? Where you were like, we're recruiting him, but not pushing real hard. And the kid ends up being great. And was like, damn, we missed that. What, name a player you're tweeting.
Well, I'll tell you, you mentioned Tommy Paul. Tommy Paul pretty much, he committed to us and then got a great offer and wound up turning pro. But so we missed out on him. The next year he came and watched the NCAAs in Athens with the team and the clubhouse and all that stuff. He actually has always said, I wish I'd gone to college for a year or so, but, that was one that, you know, got away a little bit, but, I recruited, Tsitsipas and he decided to turn pro. Not a bad decision.
Wow.
A few others, to be honest with you. I mean, so many of them that we've had a lot of guys that turned pro there. As you well know, probably the most famous case is John Roddick played for me. And while he was playing, his 10-year-old little brother or 12-year-old little brother, Andy, was running all over the place during many of his tennis matches. His mom and dad, Jerry and Blanche Roddick, used to come all the time to watch John's, play some of the matches. And this little kid, this little runt, was running all over the place, going under the grandstand in the mud, getting balls from underneath the grandstand. And, he winds up, being a Kalamazoo. I think he lost at Kalamazoo, but then he went on from there and had a great fall and won the Orange Bowl and the Australian Open. And then he was gone. But we were obviously recruiting Andy since he was a little boy. He just got too good.
Oh, man. Now, I was like, yeah. I've been to Athens, and it's a beautiful campus, and all the athletic programs are great, and facilities are great. I cannot imagine Tommy Paul spending a year in Athens. He would have lost his mind.
Yeah. We would have had to have a bodyguard, but that's okay. I mean,
that is crazy. So who is the best player in Georgia history to not try his hand at the Pro Tour? Because we see that a lot in tennis, where we have really smart guys, right? Guys that come from good homes, that have options. And they may say, tennis is great, but it's hard, and financially it's a bad investment. Who's a player that played for Georgia that you think, could have spent a year or two on tour and made it eventually that never tried?
That never tried. Probably the first one to come to mind is Hisham Hameda from Egypt. He was our number one player when we won the national championship in 1999. And he was a beautiful one-handed backhand. He was so talented. Hisham came to Athens, to Georgia, when he was barely turned 17. So he graduated from high school early. Bobby McKinley, I ran into him at the U.S. Open juniors, and he went like, I got a player for you. So I went to watch Hisham, and, he won a round or two, and I think lost. And we had him over for a visit, and he became a Bulldog. And, his last year, he was number two in the nation in singles. And I kept going like, Hisham, you're going to go out there and play, aren't you? And he said, Coach. And he just kept telling me, Coach, I am not living out of a suitcase. It's not the lifestyle I want. And I always felt like Hisham would have been a terrific top 100, top 50. Who knows what he could have done? But he was so talented, a beautiful player to watch, and just had it all. But he never gave it a try. But he's very successful, living in Abu Dhabi now. The other one I could think of is Matthias Boker, who, by the way, go out. He went out there and played pro tennis for, I think, 1 or 2 years, but he had a couple of little injuries. And I think, honestly, I don't know, you know, Matias won the NCAA singles back to back in 2001 and 2002. And won the triple crown. There's only been like 2 or 3 players that won the team singles and doubles on the same year. And that was back when, you know, we had to play 2 rounds of singles in one day. After the team tournament, 16 teams, not 8 like it's now, 16 teams. So it's 1 extra day of the team. Then in the draw, you had to play 2 rounds of singles on a Friday and 2 rounds of doubles, 2 out of 3 sets, 2 rounds of doubles on Saturday, quarters and finals. And, you know, you talk about a feat. That guy was outstanding. But he went out there for a little bit, but I never thought he really stayed out there long enough. You know, he had a twin brother. They became separated for the first time ever. I'm not sure he was happy out there all alone and by himself. And, you know, I was with him in the finals of the ATP event in Atlanta, watching John. I think it was in the finals or semis, and he went like, I should have been out there. I went like, yes dude, you would have been out there. But I think he would have definitely been one that would have made it.
So you mentioned 0102. I was at Florida A&M at the time. We had a guy on our team, Jerry Joseph, whose brother Leslie, we were recruiting and lost to you all. Definitely remember Matias kind of doing that. So now Ethan Quinn, right? So number one, I think Ethan was probably a kid last year who, prior to his freshman year, probably could have started a pro career, right? And started playing a challenge, et cetera. How do you convince a kid like that? Or did you even have to come spend a year at college? Is it, you know, need more time on the court, need to, you know, sharpen your teeth a little bit, need to grow a little bit, need to get a little more size? How do you convince a kid to come there when he could turn pro?
Yeah. Well, I don't think Ethan was ready to turn pro in his own mind, right? I don't think he was quite there yet. He needed to get stronger. The way things happened with Ethan came a semester early. In other words, the second half of his senior high school year, he had a good summer, but he had a terrible fall. He didn't have anybody to practice with, to train with in his hometown of Fresno, California. Brad Stein had already gone on the road with Tommy Paul. Brad, you know, was his mentor and his coach, you know, and brought him along. So he felt like he didn't really have anybody to push him or train him. And so when he went to the Orange Bowl and lost first round, he was very frustrated and felt that he had lost a whole lot of momentum. So he calls me, or his mom calls me early in December and says, hey, is it too late for us to try to get Ethan into school? And so we had to work very fast, and we said, heck yeah, let's do it. But he wanted to be eligible for 4 full years. He actually, he says, I want to play my 4 years at Georgia. And I want to be a part of when we host it my senior year. So, you know, that was in his mind, he didn't think he was ready to play in our lineup his freshman year. I must look like the dumbest guy in the world for not playing him. But he actually, that was his wish. He wanted to train hard. He wanted to get stronger. He wanted to work on his flexibility. His hip mobility was one issue that, you know, our specialists found that he needed to, you know, get better at. And so there were things that he wanted to address so that he could be ready to go the next fall. Needless to say, he really improved while redshirting at Georgia, just practicing with all of our guys. We had a great deep squad, so he had great practices. He got an extra time every time he went, you know, like he got an extra lift every week. He got with our strength and conditioning coaches, our medical staff, and worked on his flexibility and really had a great summer last summer. Catapulted him up there in the, what is it, five something ATP ranking, won a couple of tournaments. And then he has the great year that he had this year. So, you know, everybody is on their own timetable, right? It's hard to predict. But yeah, did I know that he could have helped us last year? Yes, absolutely. But I was, you know, I was having to consider his wishes. Number one, he wasn't sure he could play right away when he got there as a senior in high school. Right. I think he could have, no doubt that he could have. But, you know, we thought that was good reason for him. And so we honored his wishes and continue to work very hard with him. And, you know, couldn't be prouder of Ethan and the kind of year that he's had.
So I think that his progression speaks to the environment. Give us a day in the life as a college tennis player at UGA. Do we encourage the kids to have their classes all be in the morning, come get some individual work, and then do team practice in the afternoon? What is a day in the life of a UGA men's tennis player?
Well, we try to get our guys to have a little bit of a flexible schedule so that we can schedule at least three individual practices during the morning. So we will have strength work, you know, strength and conditioning work three mornings of the week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday.
As a team?
As a team, yeah, 6:30 to 7:30. There may be some guys that have classes at 8 or maybe later. So based on your schedule, some of the guys went to lift and do our conditioning workout in the morning. And then at 8 o'clock, they, you know, two or three would come for an individual workout, individual practice where we get to work a little bit more on, you know, making adjustments, making tweaks, technique, this or that specific stuff. So, at least 3 days a week, some of the guys will come 4 and 5. We kind of leave a little bit up to them to develop some responsibility for it. So we encourage them to take a little bit of leadership there as well. But we schedule at least two or three individual practices for them in the mornings, whether it's before classes, in between classes, or after classes, and before team practice at 2:30. So they go to lunch whenever, some at 12, 12:30, whatever, whenever their schedule allows. And we try to get everybody to be done with classes by 1 o'clock. You go to class probably 1 or 2, 3 hours a day. Mm-hmm. Some of these, since COVID, some of these classes are now online. So we have a lot more flexibility to have individual practices with them. It just frees up a little bit more time. And then our practice is about 2.5 hours in the afternoon. And like I say, the days where we don't have the morning conditioning, we'll do fitness after practice. So, you know, our 2:30 practice, we may be done at 5, and from 5 to 5:40 or 5:45, we may do some conditioning work, some agility or conditioning work after practice. So we're done, you know, about 5:30 or so. It's a long day, but they respond.
Yeah, you got to occupy these teenagers' time so they don't get into trouble. You know, you got to occupy it. That 6:30 workout is good. It's like, hey guys, you got to go to bed now. You know,
well, you don't even have to tell them if you have a good day like that. Yeah, I mean, you know, by 11 o'clock, they're down.
Right. So NIL, right? So we've seen, you know, men's basketball, women's basketball, men's football really capitalize on NIL. I don't know mm-hmm. that the same level of opportunity has hit college tennis yet. Tell us about your experience. But if it is, it's going to hit at UGA. It's going to hit at UCLA, Texas, right? It's going to hit you guys first. Tell me about your experience with NIL in men's tennis so far.
Well, it's changing year to year. I mean, like, it's like the horse is out of the barn, right? And I hear more schools, like, conversing with prospects about opportunities that are out there for the existing student athlete. We're not, so when we recruit kids, we cannot promise them an NIL money. So we don't. We just tell them we have a collective that works locally with all of our UGA athletes and trying to help them secure opportunities on their behalf. And you know, we can allude to, you know, two or three of our kids that have some NIL opportunities already on our team. They can inquire about those. You know, if the student athlete wants to share, and they do, but you know, we have, you know, in our athletic department, we have advisors for them. We educate them on how to pursue and how to establish their brand, but we don't secure deals for our athletes. We cannot. But you know, that doesn't mean everybody is doing the right thing or the exact thing, but I don't know. You know, that's the rules right now. And they're going to continue to get regulated because, you know, it was like the Wild West. And I think that they're trying to make sure that, you know, things, you know, remain sort of rational, I guess, and not get too far out of control. But the horse is out of the barn. I mean, you see these football players making over $1 million. There's, I don't know, if you know, a couple of football players last year, you know, doing just huge NIL deals. And that's great. That's great that they have that opportunity. It's all new to me, obviously. You know, it's coming towards the end of my career. It's not like I'm 25 and, you know, trying to be more aggressive with it. You know, it's great. And Ethan was able to benefit. I think we had one or two other kids that had some opportunities that came about. And I think it's going to keep growing for our, you know, for our program. You know, we've got a great group of lettermen that are so supportive. So, you know, they continue to improve opportunities for our guys.
And former college tennis player, fan of the sport, coach pro players. I think when you look at sort of the average income of a professional tennis player, given the number of weeks and how long of a season they play, we probably are all underpaid, right? So what is
that's right.
And tennis especially, right? What do you think we need to do in tennis to sort of reach the level, you know, if at all possible, of a college basketball? Number one is, how do we get it on TV more, right? I mean, the TV exposure really impacts your NIL opportunity. You know, how do we sort of work together so that if we got an 11 or 12-year-old boy who's a great athlete and good at tennis, but also good at basketball, how do we keep that kid in the game and not have him choose basketball at 15 just because there's more money?
Yeah, and that's the eternal battle, right? That's a big challenge we face in college tennis. And, you know, if we can't do better than we're doing right now, we're going to stagnate. I mean, softball has just left us behind. Soccer, you know, I don't know what the answer is, but, you know, we're not getting the tennis, the Golf Channel. I mean, I forgot the number of hours the Golf Channel had for golf, for college golf on their network. We don't get the same thing, you know, in college tennis. You know, we have an issue with what it takes to produce a product on TV with our format. But that's what it makes it. On the other side of the coin, it's what makes college tennis so exciting. You come out to a tennis match and you have six football games going on, right? And you can be attracted to this court because of the style. You could be attracted to this court because of the energy. You could be attracted down the road to that other court over there because it's coming down to a tiebreaker. You have so much to choose from it makes college tennis just a phenomenal in-person experience. Everybody that comes out, I had so many fans this year that came out and looked me up or wrote me or emailed me or whatever and said, I hadn't been to a college tennis match. This is just the best thing ever. And I'm a fan for life now, but we cannot reach the numbers unless we get ourselves on TV, and we got to find a way. We got to find a way. We got to continue to beat the drums, and you know, hopefully Tennis Channel will come up and do a little bit more next year, and you know, and UTR I think is doing, you know, the Final Eight on YouTube TV or YouTube channel. But we need to get that thing done. We need to get the ball in the end zone when it comes to exposure, because we're losing you know, a lot of kids to other sports. If you don't see, you know, if you don't see yourself in, you know, in that player on TV, you know, it's they're going to gravitate to other sports.
Yeah. Well, Manny, you've been so generous with your time. I know you had a long season. I want to congratulate you again. Thank 29 you. Successful seasons, SEC Coach of the Year, numerous times you can't even count. Recently, talk about smart recruiting, right? To say, oh yeah, Ethan, come on and just sit out for half a semester and then win NCAAs next year, right? You know, like recruiting genius. I appreciate your time. I congratulate you on a great career and continued success to the Bulldogs. And man, you know, if I had had parents that played tennis and sort of knew what they were doing when I was a kid, I would have loved to have gone to Georgia. I mean, Athens is just a fiery sort of tennis environment. You almost feel like it's a football game, right? The way the student body comes and supports tennis, right? You know, I went to FAMU. We didn't have anybody come watch us play. So I want to congratulate you not only on recruiting, but also on the environment that you have to create energy around tennis. So congratulations.
Appreciate it. And it's great being with you, Kamau.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.